Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Alan Levy Show at blogtalkradio.com. Be prepared to call in now and chat with Alan and his very special guest right here at blogtalkradio.com. With no more further ado, please welcome your host, Mr. Alan Levy.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm the founder and CEO of Blog Talk Radio, and welcome to a new year and, closing the books. We've closed the books on 2007, and we're very, very excited about what's happening in 2008. So welcome to my show today. It's the Alan Levy Show again on blogtalkradio.com, and my co-host I'll introduce now is Hillary, as always. How are you, Hillary?
Hi, Alan. Doing well. How are you?
Very good. Are you well rested after the craziness of the holiday season?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I certainly haven't had a chance to rest too much because things are really busy on Blog Talk Radio, which is, of course, good. But
I know. You told me that yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Things are popping all over the place, so we're excited about that.
Definitely.
So drink lots of tea and take vitamins.
I'll do my best.
And we have a special show today. I'm very excited to introduce our listeners to David Andelman. David is the executive editor of Forbes.com. He's a journalist and author, and he's written a book called The Shattered Peace, Versailles 1919, and The Price We Pay Today. David will be our guest. We'll be here momentarily. If you'd like to call into the show, feel free. The caller number is 347-677-0649. It's 347-677-0649. So let's welcome David in. How are you, David?
I'm well, thanks, Alan. Great, and Hillary. It's a great pleasure and honor to be on your show. It's a great show.
Well, great. Thank you very much for being here. And this is a very timely book that you've written, Treaty of Versailles, in particular what's going on in the Middle East and how things are evolving here. And now we also have the presidential election. So it's quite an interesting time for you and for, your readers. So what do you make of this now? What's happening?
Well, it's interesting. I've gotten a lot of resonance from it, even from some of the political candidates. Ron Paul, for instance, his returns have so far been marginal, but he's had some interesting points that he's made in the course of the campaign. And one of them is to trace the, as I do in this book in considerable detail, trace the problems that we have in places like Iraq and so on back 100 years to the mistakes that were made back in 1919 at the end of the First World War, the treaty that ended the First World War, because that's when Woodrow Wilson and a whole group of Americans and a bunch of Europeans, the British, the French, the Italians, they all got together, the victorious powers, and they dictated how the world was going to be restructured. They redrew all the lines, the same borders in many cases, especially in Iraq, the same borders that we are defending today with our blood. And it's really sad, the hash they made of it back then that we're having to pay for now. And that's basically the theme of the book. And it's also, to a very great degree, it's a theme of the campaign as well, the political campaign so far.
Well, let's go back to that. So where do you think, I know that, there's obviously, let's just talk about the Treaty of Versailles for our audience.
Sure.
Some of them, most of them were not living then.
Right. Probably all of them.
We are an internet web-based platform. So why don't you go back a little, talk about that, and then maybe get into why do you think that the borders were not properly developed?
Okay. Well, the Treaty of Versailles was the treaty that the Western powers, the victors, the guys who won World War I, the U.S., the British, the French, the Italians, and so on, all of our allies in World War I, they defeated the Central Powers, the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, and the Ottoman Empire, which then included Turkey and all of the rest of the Middle East, basically, most of the rest of the Middle East. Those were the losers, and the Americans and the British and the French and so on got together and dictated a peace to these people. In other words, they said, this is the shape of the world that is going to be going forward. And that was where they made all of their mistakes, because when they got together in Paris, they drew up countries. There were no countries in the Middle East in those days. It was one big Ottoman Empire. It was just a vast. It went from Greece all the way down through what's now Israel and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and so on, all the way back up around towards actually North Africa. And that was the Ottoman Empire at one time. And they divided all of this up into individual countries. The problem was that the countries that they drafted then, Iraq was one of them, they had no idea of who was in those countries, who existed in those countries, what kinds of people they were, what they believed in, what their religion was. Basically, they were just a bunch of various tribes of different religions, all of whom fundamentally hated each other, you know, and had been at war with each other for centuries. They tried to put all of these into one country, and that was the mistake. They put the Kurds there, they put the Shiites, they put the Sunnis. We've heard all about them.
I mean, you're talking about Iraq in particular.
It's Iraq, and right, yeah. We'll talk first about Iraq. They also did the same thing in many other parts of the world. They did this in the Balkans, in Yugoslavia, hence all of our problems in Kosovo and all the bloodshed there. They did it in Asia. They did it in other parts of Eastern Europe. They did the same thing all over the world. But the most immediate problem, of course, for us right now is Iraq, and that's where they made a colossal error. And in what was then called Palestine, you had the State of Israel was created, effectively, back in 1919. And instead of giving part of that area to the Palestinian Arabs to have their homeland, they gave it all to Israel. And the result was now we have the Palestinians agitating, often at the point of a gun, to get their own territory in Palestine. Just as the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shiites are each trying to get their own territories in Iraq, and frankly, that's probably the best outcome of this whole thing, if you put it together, is to divide these countries back up into what they should have been divided into at the end of World War I and were not. And that's how we might be able to get out of this with our skins.
Well, of course, the challenge is, I mean, that's just, you know, you have the Sunni, the Sunni contingent, which was Saddam Hussein, correct?
Right, absolutely.
And then, of course, the Shiite, which is really Iran.
Exactly.
And, you know, and they're the real fundamentalists, mm-hmm. that's causing lots of problems. And then, of course, you have the Osama bin Laden, who's he's a Sunni, though, isn't he?
Osama bin Laden, yes, indeed. He is a Sunni. And the Sunnis, remember, are also dominant in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So, yes, indeed, he is. He's a radical Sunni, of course.
Right, he's a radical Sunni. So, you know, you if you redesign the, you know, you have oil reserves that are, you know, bubbling up through all this,
right.
and percolating, and that's further complexity. So
absolutely.
It's certainly a very volatile area, and there's been a lot written on it. And what stimulated you to write about the Treaty of Versailles and how the lines were drawn and the impact it's had on today's world?
Well, it's interesting. I was a foreign correspondent for much of my career. I was with the New York Times for 12 years, and then I was Paris correspondent for CBS News for 7 years. And in the course of those really 20 years I spent overseas, 2 decades, I traveled all over the world, and I traveled to more than 50 countries. And each place I went, I would ask people, where do you think the problems of your country really began? Where did they go off the rails, if you will? And almost every one of them, the ones who thought seriously about this, I thought they'd say the Cold War or, you know, World War II, or in Asia maybe the Vietnam War, the Korean War. They almost all said, you know, I really think it has to be the World War I, the end of the World War I, the Treaty of Versailles. That's where we really went off the rails. And I had written my thesis in college about the ratification of the Treaty of Versailles, which, of course, failed. It did not get through the Senate, and that was another disaster waiting to happen. It was something I'd been interested in. Finally, you know, I sort of got to a critical mass. I said, this is something that needs to be written now, especially in view of what was happening first in Kosovo, in the Balkans, and then now in Iraq. And it seemed to me that we could, in fact, find the origins of many of these problems back then, and maybe we could find the solution as well, simply by unraveling what they had done then. And that's how the book came about.
I see. Mm-hmm. And how do you, you know, the Bush was talking today. Did you see the press conference today with
mm-hmm. yes.
with Bush? Mm-hmm. You know, the Iranian threat, obviously there's a lot more rhetoric is bubbling up, and there was some, there was a discussion, actually, Bush talked about it today with the nuclear arms and their desire to have them, and that they ultimately may, at least he believes they will. How do you think Iran fits into this whole picture, and how, what would be your suggestion on how to deal with that threat?
Well, Iran is an interesting case. Iran was not involved in this. It wasn't involved in the war. It managed to stay out of the war. It was not a part of the Ottoman Empire. It had managed to avoid that as well. So it was really kind of off to the side. And remember, back then, oil was not a very big deal. World War One was really the first war where there were any, you know, gasoline-powered engines at all. There were some few biplanes up in the skies and some trucks and so on. But nobody really thought, even in the United States, nobody really thought they'd need any more oil than, for instance, you could produce in Texas or California or whatever. No one ever thought that if there was any kind of oil in the Middle East, it would be of any value, let alone Iran. So that wasn't even involved in the whole equation back then, which was another huge mistake in judgment and by the peace treaty. So they never really dealt very much with Iran, and Iran was allowed to, fundamentally was allowed to go off on its own and do whatever it wanted to do. As a result, it developed a kind of fundamentalist Islamic religion that was a rebellion against some of the military officers that were really running the country and the Shah. So now we have to deal with all of these issues, and it's a very tough question. I don't think it can be dealt with at gunpoint, frankly. I think that probably we have to sit down and we have to talk with them. We have to understand what they want out of this. What they want out of this is what most countries want. They want respect and recognition, I suspect.
Well, they also want to destroy Israel, which they've made clear.
They have talked about that. There is no question.
That's a small little matter that keeps coming up.
Well, of course. But for that matter, so in theory did Syria or parts of Lebanon, and Egypt has in the past, and so on. And there are ways of getting around that, it seems to me, if you talk about it and try to understand what they are. Look, the latest intelligence from Iran suggests that they don't even have a nuclear weapon and are not even working towards that. I suspect they didn't say anything about that because, again, they're looking to be considered a major power in the Middle East. And you can't be a major power in the Middle East, in their view at least, unless you have some kind of a nuclear weapon or are moving towards having that. And so, you know, to rush, go racing in there and try to destroy what they've built of any kind of a nuclear industry on the theory that they're building a nuclear weapon that's going to strike Israel, I think is perhaps a bit premature at the best.
I would agree. Yeah. The other interesting aspect of what's happening on in the world, and I don't think it's getting enough press, although Time magazine did put Putin on the cover.
Right, they did.
Is what's happening in Russia and what he's doing. He's you know, taking the clock back to, at least that's from my view. I mean, as we he's jailed senior executives and he's privatized the major industries of Russia. He's now, of course, he's going to be back in a role managing and bypassing the election issues. And what's your view on Putin and Russia's take on, you know, Russia's role in the Middle East and in the world?
Well, I spent a lot of time in Russia through the years. I've met actually every general secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, from Brezhnev through Yeltsin and Gorbachev. And I have to tell you, the one thing the Russian people have always wanted, they've always liked and respected a powerful ruler. That's what they've wanted. I've said this throughout the process of doing my book, and I say it in the book. I think fundamentally, every country gets the, if they're left alone, they get the kind of government, the kind of leader they really want and deserve. And I think this is what the Russian people want. They want a strong leader. They want a czar, if you will. They always had czars back centuries, you know, before the communists came along. Then you had the communist leaderships and the communist party leaders and so on. Now you have a Putin. The difference is that Russia was never an important, serious, major power, certainly not back in 1919, when I write about it in the book, nor was it, for that matter, an important power in 1999. But it becoming an important power now because of oil. And Putin has been very savvy in promoting all of that. And what we have to do is understand how to deal with this kind of a country now. Putin and the Soviet Union are not anymore, prima facie, our sworn enemies. They don't have an economic and system and a philosophy that they want to impose on our working class, like the communists did. Okay, they're not a communist country. They're a capitalist country. Capitalism won there. You know, if you go over there, you'll see every evidence of it. I mean, all you have to do is turn around and see all of the McDonald's and the Starbucks and whatever.
Right. Freedom of speech hasn't won, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, of course. But again, it's, what is democracy? Democracy and freedom of speech is something that we hold very high and we esteem, but is not necessarily what other people want. And we shouldn't be in a position necessarily of foisting it on them. Certainly there are people who are within those countries who value freedom of speech over stability. There are lots of other people in that country, a much larger majority, by the way, who value stability over things like freedom of speech, and they see stability as a strong leader at the top who runs things. You know,
I guess Hitler was also stable.
Well, to a degree.
Now, he wasn't a stable individual, but the economy was stable, right?
And, he came in at the end of the just a catastrophic economic collapse in Germany. You had hyperinflation where prices were going up 1,000% a month, and he stabilized all of that. Absolutely. Now he stabilized it again at the point of a gun. Putin hasn't done that. Putin has jailed certain people who he, you know, doesn't care for and who don't toe the line, if you will. But we do that also, don't we? I mean, you know, in this country, it's been known to happen. So it's really, I think, a little bit, it's a little unfair. And I'm not coming down on Putin's side. There are many things that he's done that I think are just appalling. There's no question about that. But look, we have to look at what the Russian people want, try to get inside their minds, if you will. This is what the Russian people want. A vast majority of them want a strong leader. They don't want unrest and instability and, you know, starvation, frankly, which was what was happening to many Russian people after the end of communism. There was things were very bad for a while there.
Right.
They're not anymore. There's
right,
food
right.
in the stores. People are eating now all over the country.
Right. Hillary, you want to talk about the book tour? And
yes, I want to talk about the book a little bit.
Okay.
Because
great.
You know,
I love the book. It's a great book.
No, of course.
Everybody should be buying it. Amazon, great place.
Amazon.com.
You know,
we can find it. It's called The Shattered Peace.
Right.
Yeah, well, I read that you are doing a lot of book tour stops and
mm-hmm.
such. Do you have anything planned for 2008 that you're excited about that you want to share with our audience?
I do. Actually, there's a wonderful event next week on the 15th at the Overseas Press Club and the World Policy Institute. At the Overseas Press Club, I'll be speaking there, signing books and so on President's Day. I will be I'll be delivering the President's Day oration. I've never delivered an oration before, but President's Day oration at the Newington Cropsey Foundation in Hastings on Hudson, New York, which is very exciting. And also, I'm going around to a lot of different bookstores in the New York City area, and I'm signing books. And, you know, I'm going on Blog Talk Radio, which hopefully will reach a nationwide audience. The most frustrating part about promoting a book, I've discovered, is just getting out there in this big country and making sure that you really do reach people out there who might conceivably be interested. You know, it's not just, sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm a door-to-door Bible salesman going around knocking on doors saying, hey, I've got a terrific book here, buy it. And I've done a lot of that. Let me tell you, I've gone around every bookstore in New York practically and you know, made sure they had it in stock and signed copies of it when I was there and left bookmarks, you know, to pass out and so on. But it's a national audience you really need. You really need to get people all over the country excited about it. And that's the real challenger.
Well, that's an area that we've really been excited with at Blog Talk Radio and in conversations with some of the largest publishers
mm-hmm.
about stations and areas within Blog Talk Radio that publishers can promote their authors.
Right.
You know, and give authors, not just current books, like you have a book that's recent, but a book written a year ago that there's backlist on that you want to refresh. That's what we're very excited about. So
mm-hmm.
we
yeah,
found
virtual
that
book tours, you don't even need to leave your house to talk to your readers. It's pretty cool.
I love that. I think that is just so exciting. I see drive time, talk time. It said so true, David. I think that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, you're very savvy with it, and I think it's a good time to talk about, you know, your other efforts, your blogging
mm-hmm.
For your book and that kind of thing, so kind of new media efforts you're
making. Yeah, I do blog, and you know, one of the things I discovered that's very valuable is the Google search function is very interesting. You can put into that, for instance, I put into that the name of the book and my name and Treaty of Versailles. And every night they send me an email that says, here are the mentions on different blogs all over the country, all over the world, really, because I've had them from England and from India and from all over the place, that have mentioned Treaty of Versailles. I then reply to each one of these and say, look, you know, here's this book. You mentioned the Treaty of Versailles. You're interested in it. Maybe you're going to be using it in a course. There's a number of cases where even high school students have come on in their blogs and said, I've got this paper on Treaty of Versailles. You know, so I go back and I respond to them. And the feedback has just been extraordinary. It really has been. It's a whole new way of getting across ideas and concepts and, you know, recognition of books that have been written that are important to people that they might not otherwise find.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that that's, you know, a great point, and it is difficult to promote a book, and as we were talking about before with the historical perspective that a lot of people don't have and how it relates to this current election and everything, it would make a great addition to a lot of this curriculum and history classes and such that's missing
exactly,
right now.
Exactly. And it's a very individual and personal choice as to what teachers assign in history classes, I'm discovering. You can't just sort of call up, you know, the press office at Harvard University and say, hey, I've got a great book. I think your history courses ought to be assigning it. You have to get to know the professors. They have to be comfortable with the book and so on. So that's a whole other kind of marketing.
I learned 2 weeks ago, I got an email from a professor at University of Wisconsin that they're using Blog Talk Radio in their class.
That is fabulous.
I'm very excited by that. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, they're actually teaching it as part of the curriculum for their students to engage others, and very excited about that.
Anytime you can engage a reader directly, I mean, we've discovered that at Forbes.com as well, is really just golden. It's just terrific. And this is what one of the real the joys of there are a lot of frustrations, believe me, in trying to promote a book. But one of the joys is to really be able to get out there and reach out and touch people and say, look, here's this wonderful book. It's a shattered piece for Psy 1919 and the price we pay today. You can find it on Amazon. But, you know, here's some of the things that are in it, and you should be interested in it. And come and explore it with me. And, you know, people send in. I have a website and an email address, and people do ask me questions all the time about the book, and I answer every email I get.
That's great. What's your take on the election, and what you know? What's happened? Obviously, it's fascinating with McCain, and who, by the way, just so you know, McCain and Huckabee, we made a blog post today, have both been very active participants on Blog Talk Radio.
So yeah, that's great.
We're very excited by that.
I bet you are. That's
when
terrific.
When McCain was down, and way down, and both Huckabee, in fact, played his instrument, his band played on Blog Talk Radio. We had him on, and McCain has been on a few times.
Yeah.
And we said, look, come on, you're always welcome here. And it's just amazing of what's going on in this election year.
It is. And, you know, we've had two ballots now in Iowa and in New Hampshire. And I said this morning on Forbes.com video. And I'm happy to share it with your listeners also, since getting these kinds of views out is important on every medium, especially one as large and as powerful as Blog Talk Radio. But what I said was, look, the first contest in Iowa, obviously people valued, in that case, they valued change over experience. And I do think we have this kind of continuum, change at one end, experience at the other. You get to New Hampshire, people seem to value experience over change. So there's this pendulum seems to be swinging back and forth, and you have the candidates who are clearly perceived as change agents, people like Barack Obama, Mike Huckabee, and you have the people who are clearly experienced people who have been there around, have been around the track, shall we say. John McCain, 71 years old. Hillary Clinton, who has been twice elected to the Senate and spent 8 years in the White House, albeit at the other end of the White House from where her husband was being president, but still, nevertheless, in the White House. And each of these has had a different kind of it's been a different kind of vote, because in one case people seem to value far more the concept of change and youth. And in the other, experience and so on. And I think it's going to be into the next couple of primaries, even before we get to Michigan. I think, or certainly before we get to Super Tuesday in February, I think we're going to be able to see just how much people value one or the other, and that will give us a sense of who our candidates are going to be in November.
Let's take a call. 949, you're on Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good morning, guys. It's Shane from Political Vindication Radio.
Hi, Shane.
Hello, and I love your interview. Mr. Andelman, you're very intelligent.
Please, it's David.
It's refreshing.
It's David.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
And your book sounds fascinating. And, you know, foreign policy, I usually see it as a chess match.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a sense of history will help us out when we know more about it.
Right.
And so my question to you is, the Versailles Treaty and World War One and leading to World War Two, what were the lessons that Europe learned from that? Because I know America learned some lessons from what was going on over there, but did Europe learn the lessons, and were those the right lessons learned from the Versailles Treaty?
Well, probably not, actually. In fact, that's why we wound up with a Second World War. It's interesting. There were a lot of young diplomats and politicians who were amazing characters. And the characters who showed up in Paris, they'd make a wonderful novel. I originally started to write this as a novel, actually, and realized it would be better as a factual book. But the characters are amazing. Some of these people, like Harold Nicholson, who was a member of the Bloomsbury Group, he was married to Virginia Woolf's lover. There's a whole lot of amazing characters. Alan Dulles, who later became head of the CIA. These were young people in their 20s who came there as junior diplomats. They all came with the idea that they were going to change the traditional way things were done, politics was done in Europe. And they meant change the kind of things that were done 100 years before at the Congress of Vienna, where, in fact, the whole structure of Europe was set up the way it is, the way it entered World War One, and what really actually set off World War One. Well, in fact, nothing changed, because the old-timers, the people like Georges Clemenceau, the old French leader and so on, they liked the way the system was working. And they wanted the system to continue. They didn't want to change it. You know, they wanted Germany hammered into the ground, basically, because Germany had been France's enemy for 100 years, or more than that, in fact. And they wanted to make sure Germany would never rise again. The result was they put together this treaty that was designed to make sure that they were supreme in Europe. Well, it's like putting a lid on a pressure cooker. You know, if you don't let it up, eventually let the pressure up, it's going to explode. And that's exactly what happened at the end of the 1930s, after 20 years of the lid being on this pressure cooker, thanks to the Treaty of Versailles. So we had World War II.
Wow.
Does that help?
Yes, it does. It does, just in the sense that the idealism that drove that treaty and that time of optimism, you know, right up to that point, there was a real optimism that things could change.
Oh, sure.
And it really blew up in everybody's faces.
Well, it did. And, you know, Wilson came over there with his 14 points,
yeah,
which were self-determination, you know, open treaties, openly arrived at, democracy for the world, and so on. And frankly, he got his lunch eaten by the old tigers of Europe. They had no interest in his idealism or anything else. And the result was they took him to the cleaners. In fact, I have a wonderful little anecdote in there where some of the old British diplomats went out to had a picnic in the country right outside of Paris right after the treaty was concluded. And they were laughing among each other, and they said, you know, we picked old Wilson's pockets clean down to the pocket lint. And he didn't even notice that they had their hands in his pockets. I mean, that's what it was like. It was a game to them, and Wilson had no idea of the rules he was playing by. The result was World War II. The result was later on in the century was Iraq and Kosovo and so on. And as I explained in the Shattered Peace, it's unfortunate, but that was what the world was like.
Well, it sounds like an excellent book, and I'm on Amazon right now taking a look at it.
What a guy.
Your time today.
Half price, Shane, on Amazon.
Thank you, Shane.
And a money-back guarantee if you don't love it. How's that?
Thank you, Shane, for your
right.
call. And,
thank you,
and
Shane.
Your show again on Blog Talk Radio is Political...
Political yes. Vindication Radio. We're on every Tuesday, and we try to get on guests just like this here to talk about history and policy and politics. And so I appreciate you guys as well. Thank you.
Great.
That's
thank
great.
You.
And if you want me back at some point, Vindication, I'm there for you. How's that?
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Yep.
We have, you know, excited. You know, Shane, Political Vindication is a great show, and it's got a nice following on Blog Talk Radio. Well, this has been enjoyable. We had about a minute remaining,
okay.
And it was lots of, you know, very interesting, informative. This is a very, as I said at the outset, it's a very timely topic and a very important one for you know, people here to understand, particularly the younger generation as well, which is really maybe a topic of another day, because we're not getting news.
Sure.
We talked about this when we had a meeting at one point, that we're not getting news to them, and so it's fascinating.
Excellent. Well, we'll get this book to them. It'll be great.
Perfect. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
Thanks so much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very for having good. Me. A Shattered Peace. Wonderful book. Great
okay.
read.
All right. Very good.
Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hillary.
Yes.
So let's talk another few moments we've got. We have tomorrow, 3 p.m., Brian Clark, copy blogger.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. We'll
Should
see you
be
then.
Another great show. Everyone in the chat room, thanks for joining us. And
yeah.
we got another book sold.
Yeah, exactly.
just during our show. We're so
play
convincing.
The bumper.
All right, we'll do. Signing
bye.
Off.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining Alan and Hillary on the Alan Levy Show. Make sure to join the conversation by calling 347-677-0649 and listen to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk.